Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of solutions and the podcast of hope. I'm your host, Rory Hearn, and I'm joined today on Reboot Republic by Ben Phillips. Ben is the author and activist and longtime civil society campaigner who has been advisor to the UN, to governments and civil society organizations. His new book, How to Fight Inequality, has been roundly acclaimed by those in the inequality field. It's an absolutely excellent read. I would encourage people to read it as a guide for not just what is wrong with inequality, but most importantly, what are the solutions and what can be done. And in terms of inequality, it is one of the key issues that we've looked on this podcast. It's one of the issues that we continue to highlight, and particularly solutions. And I'm delighted to be joined by Ben. Ben, thanks for joining us today on Reboot Republic.
Thanks so much for having me, Rory. Great to be with you.
And it's particularly great, Ben, given that you have an Irish connection. You are the great-grandson of Padraig Pearse, the Irish rebel.
Grandnephew.
Grandnephew.
He had no kids. The only one in the family that had kids was his younger sister, Mary Kate. And she's my great-grandmother. Now, you can hear from my accent that I'm English. What happened was that Mary Kate was staying at a hotel, the Royal Hotel in Galway, on holiday. And there was another guest who had really upset her because he'd made a mess of the communal bathroom. So she went to complain to the management, and the management made the guest apologize. He was a guy called Sidney Shovelton. He was English. She liked him. She married him. And so the Pearse family continued and continued as English, Irish kids. But in that passing down, we continued to honor that legacy and are hugely proud of that connection at the centenary in 2016. The president kindly invited me along with other relatives, and it was so beautiful to meet them, particularly the kids of the people that had been imprisoned in Wales. And to hear their stories about what they had been through, what their parents had been through. It was a really beautiful gathering. And we were all, as relatives, treated so so well. At one point, I turned to another of the relatives and said, "Hey, they've given us better seats than the politicians." And he said, "Quite right, too." But it was a really beautiful celebration of the 16. And I think in connection with our conversation, one of the things that really struck me as I spoke with people about the meaning of the rebellion, the meaning of the proclamation, the meaning of the vision of independence, was that it was never a kind of narrow nationalism that said simply, we want to replace, you know, English leaders with Irish ones. It was about equal rights and equal opportunities for all, cherishing all children equally. And it was a struggle for decency. It was a struggle to replace land grabbing by the rich with fair land redistribution to the poor, a struggle to replace cramped slums with room to move, painful hunger with full stomachs, squalor with dignity, exploitation with decent work, corporate impunity with workers' rights, inequality with equality, hopelessness with hope, and shame with self-worth. And the rebels saw those struggles for political democracy, economic justice, and cultural self-confidence as utterly inseparable. And I think that vision, that radical vision, has been allowed to get a little bit lost by the establishment. But at the centenary, there was a kind of renaissance of that story. And I'm really excited today when I see the vibrant movements that are winning victories in Ireland for equality, for justice. And I think there's a real opportunity. So for me, that connection with Pearse is not just a wonderful, beautiful coincidence of history, but is also an inspiration for now and next.
And that's really incredible to hear that, because, you know, for many of us, the proclamation and its aspirations around, you know, equality for everyone is, and for all citizens, is something that has inspired us and motivated us in terms of, you know, questioning what type of country we live in, and, you know, is it fulfilling the values of a republic? And I would be even more critical than you put it there. It's not just that the establishment and governments, you know, haven't, you know, they've really, in many ways, that idea, I think, of that social aspect of that social revolution is still yet to happen in that sense of achieving the social and economic rights of all citizens. But just specifically, was it within the family? What did that history influence you, or that, you know, that connection to, like, how you became interested and engaged with social justice and inequality? Did that family history influence that path of yours?
Absolutely. It was the first kind of story that I was told of great injustice, but also of how people could beat back that great injustice. And, you know, later on in life, I went to live in India, and then in Kenya and South Africa too. All those countries also had to free themselves from the same guys, from us. Yeah. And they felt an affinity to the Irish story. Many of the freedom movements were inspired by the Irish, which was the first victory of indigenous people against the empire, and showed that it could be beaten. So so absolutely. But also, as I mentioned, you know, Pierce was an idealist, and he, you know, James Connolly is this powerful, great leader of workers, and Constance Markovitch, an inspiring feminist. There's something about Pierce's belief in the impossible that I think is worth holding on to. There's a wonderful American rabbi, Rabbi Lerner, who has this tale which he says, be unrealistic, you know, and he points out that it's only the unrealistic that have ever won change. George Bernard Shaw made the same point, you know, the reasonable man bends himself to the time, and the unreasonable man seeks to bend society to him. And therefore, he says, all progress depends on the unreasonable man. And Pierce said, the wise have pitied the fool that has striven to give a life, to dream that was dreamed in the heart, that only the heart could hold. And then he says, oh, wise man, riddle me this. What if the dream come true? And it's, there's nothing wrong with dreaming. There's nothing wrong with idealism. In fact, when I looked back in history at when have fights against inequality been won, they start with a vision, with a bigger picture. They start with dreaming. Angela Davis, the great civil rights leader and great American academic today, talks about the value of dreaming. And, you know, I would say hold on to that idealism. Loads of people will tell you, well, you know, that's, you know, give up on the dream straight away. You know, start with the compromise, start with the thing that's kind of slightly more livable than what we've got now. But change has never been won in that way. And we're at a moment now with COVID. It's a horrific moment. But we have also seen often in history that it's from those horrific moments that great change has been won. In the 1930s in the US, from the Great Depression, is what led to the New Deal. After the Second World War, it's what led a lot of Western Europe to reestablish itself with social democracy. It's what led to the foundation of the United Nations. When the AIDS crisis ravaged Thailand, it was that that led them to free healthcare. So these moments that we're in now, these moments of crisis, are also moments of opportunity. And this is a moment where dreams no longer seem unrealistic. Now, dangerously, neither are nightmares unrealistic. And so there are darker forces of xenophobic nationalism, of misogyny, of minority baiting, those forces that seek to say to the weak and to the oppressed that the people they need to be frightened of are those who are weaker and more oppressed. Those forces are also rising too. But what we do know is that the status quo is broken. And so really we have a choice of two futures. The old world is gone, and what will replace it will either be something much worse, or will be something along the lines of the kind of dream that you and I have been talking about.
And you've captured it very, very well. I think, you know, a lot of people's sense of this moment that, you know, when we look at particularly, you know, healthcare, for example, and, you know, the access that people are, you know, not having to healthcare. And even, for example, at the moment right now in Ireland, we have non-COVID related healthcare being stopped in public hospitals because the hospitals are being overrun. But as someone pointed out, the private hospitals are still open where you can, if you have money, you can go access your care to a certain extent. And so these inequalities, and we see it in housing, for example, the whole idea I've been struck by, you know, and studied this and highlighted it, the issue of stay at home. Mm. And what about those people who don't have a home, or those people who are in overcrowded accommodation, or those people who are living in, you know, the direct provision for asylum seekers, or those people who are, you know, living in basically damp, you know, housing that isn't safe or lacks green space that, you know, and you talk about this, that, you know, COVID highlights these inequalities, that it magnifies them.
Yeah, it magnifies them. But it magnifies them in two ways. It magnifies them in the sense that it makes them worse, but it also magnifies them in the sense of a magnifying glass, that it exposes them. You know, now, if you ask kids who their heroes are now, no one anymore says, oh, it's Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and the tech bros. No one says that. They say it's nurses and teachers. It's essential workers who've put their lives and themselves on the line for the greater good. We've really rediscovered the public. There's no romanticism anymore about these super wealthy people. No one looks to them with admiration. No one says, oh, well, those guys, wow. They've really, you know, the 650 billionaires in the States who've increased their wealth by $1 trillion, Jeff Bezos alone by $70 million in this pandemic alone. No one looks at him and says, wow, I want to be that kind of guy. So it's really exposed what's wrong. And that really does give us a chance to put it right. So that's where I see hope. Now, there's no automaticity in this, because we should have learned this lesson in the 2008 crash, shouldn't we?
Yeah.
I mean, that really, the 2008 crash absolutely proved the failure of neoliberalism. If neoliberalism was a project that was intended to improve our lives, it isn't. So it succeeded in its real mission, but failed demonstrably in its official mission. And yet it wasn't the neoliberals that were punished. And, you know, we saw the Irish establishment, for example, you know, protect its banksters and impose the costs on the poorest people, impose the costs on the wages of the lowest paid and those trapped in negative equity with houses that they'd never be able to pay back. And we also see people play with nasty rhetoric that attacks, for example, the traveller community or that attacks the new Irish community of Black Irish people. There are vicious forces who want to play in this moment too. And what happens for the 1% is that they can sense that there is anger and they don't want it focused on them. So they have a clear self-interest in helping to divert that frustration onto those who look different, love different, or pray different.
And do you think that, in a sense, you know, you described that the level of inequality that we're at, that, you know, because there's a lot of debate in Ireland about, you know, that we're kind of mid-table inequality, you know, that the, even though we have the highest gross income inequality before taxation in the EU, but then our taxation system, income tax system, distributes that in terms of across the incomes. And so we become more equal when you look at post-tax and transfers. But yet we have massive wealth inequality, where, you know, that there's a lot of the way in which, and of course, we look at the United States, where you've got the most extreme inequalities. We look at Scandinavian countries with, you know, much less inequality, that, you know, the, when you talk about inequality, you do need to look at different countries, don't you? And kind of analyze what is the specific level of inequality? What is the nature of it? Or do you think we can broadly say that inequality across all countries is growing or has grown significantly?
Yeah, inequality has been getting worse across the world for the past pretty much 50 years. The one exception to that is Latin America. So Latin America had a good an expiring period between about the year 2000 and the year 2015, so about a decade and a half, where they were really pushing against inequality, where you saw, and it started with social movements. It started with indigenous people. It started with landless people. And you saw these beautiful coming together of different movements, of movements of workers, small farmers, the landless, indigenous people, but also mestizo and white, together fighting against kind of old aristocracy that had obscene type holdings. So we did see, you know, in one significant region of the world, real progress in the early 2000s. In the rest of the world, really since about 1975 or 1980, bit beyond, things have kind of been getting worse decade on decade. So even the Scandinavian model, Scandinavia is, as you said, much more equal than the rest of the world, but even they've been getting less equal in the past few decades, although from a better place and less rapidly, and they've still managed to hold on to some of the best parts. But we've really been fighting a losing battle for, you know, 4 or 5 decades. What's exciting now is that some of the conditions that brought about the original shift. So across Europe, we saw from, depending on where you were, for some it was the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s, but really then lasted until about the 1970s across Europe and across much of the rest of the world. The reason for that was that we saw a rising, particularly of the trade union movement, what's called trade union density, basically means when more people belong to a trade union, it doesn't just change what happens in their company, it changes what happens in their country. You end up with a fairer society. We saw that across Europe. We also saw more challenging to those in power, more organizing, and this alternative vision, this vision that it was possible to have a more equal society and that we lived for something more than for work and for the market. We've seen really a pushback against that. But in the past few years, we have seen a reemergence of some of those forces that in the past had led to those breakthroughs. That's what gives me hope. When I looked back and I asked for the book, How to Fight Inequality, I looked back and asked when had it happened before and how had it happened before? And it had never happened because you just happened to have a really good elite in power that gave it to you, that were just wise or that were better informed. It never was a self-correction by the market. And it was never uncontentious. It was always difficult. So the people who pushed for it were always called difficult. They only won because they joined forces and challenged, and because they had a vision that they were able to win people around to of something bigger and better. That's happening again now, and that's our potential. What we also saw in the past was this thing around crisis moments, but crisis moments are only opportunity moments if people are organized to seize that opportunity. You can think of it a bit like heat. So if you think of social structures a bit like glass or metal, they're hard, but in heat, they become malleable. But in which direction will they be bent? Well, they'll be bent in the direction in which they're pushed. So who's pushing them in which direction? This is our opportunity to seize, and people are. So we don't need to start anything. We just need more people in it.
And just, I want to ask you in terms of that, like, where are those forces? But before we go on to that, I want you to kind of maybe give your analysis of, you know, what has caused that rise in inequality over the last 30, 40 years? What have been the key factors in causing that? Because we need to understand that in order to be able to change it.
Sure. The policies are things like deregulation, financialization, a kind of trickle-down economics that seeks to have a low tax on those at the top, but push consumption taxes on people at the bottom, that take away rights at work, that remove the protections that ordinary people have, and that kind of in a kind of neoliberal sense, set the market free, but do so by making people unfree. That's the kind of policy mix. And so the policy mix, to put it back, is known. The policy mix to fix society involves progressive taxation, including wealth taxation. It involves strong universal public services. It involves getting money in the hands of ordinary people, whether that's through child benefit, pensions, universal basic income, whatever are the various different mechanisms for getting cash in the hands of ordinary people, strengthening rights at work and minimum wages, tackling forms of discrimination, whether that's gender, race, class, etc. That's the mix. And then in countries where it's relevant, land reform has been really key too. So we know the mix. It's not a mystery. It's what was done by the Lula government, for example, in Brazil, so successfully in the 2000s, but it's also what was done in Europe. It's also, ironically, a lot of those pieces are part of what became known as the Asian Tigers, you know, which were seen as such success for capitalism, but were, you know, when you look at the policy mix, you see a massive redistribution of wealth and an expansion of public services. So we kind of know what to do at the policy level, but there's things behind it in terms of how politics is driven. So one part of it is that organized people stop this. And so in order to pursue the neoliberal agenda, the 1% needs for us to be disorganized. They need for us to be individualist. They need for us to think that the union isn't us, the employees, working together. We have to think that the union is some outside difficult force. We have to think that people that are struggling in related but separate struggles, so people who are struggling for racial justice, if you're a man, people who are struggling for women's rights and gender justice, for us to see those groups as our opponents rather than our allies. They want us to be disunited, because when we're organized and strong, those things don't happen. So that's the second part. You see a breakup. You see laws that seek to restrict the ability of independent organizations, whether that's free trade unions or NGOs or community groups, etc., to flourish. You see that, but you also see a kind of messaging campaign that seeks to break that apart. So that's the second thing you see. And then the third thing you see is a story that says, you know, we're going to build a meritocracy. We're going to build a society where anyone can become a millionaire, and anyone who doesn't become a millionaire is a failure who should, you know, kind of walk in shame with a bell tied around their neck and be avoided. You know, that's the third part. And that third part is really, really important and powerful. And so here's a call out to the people that work in policy and the people, the think tank, you know, the progressive intellectuals who play a really important role when we think about policy and when we think about, you know, analyzing what's wrong and what needs to be put right. But there's a weakness sometimes in progressive intellectuals, which is that they'll say, well, you know, we're the science guys, we're techie, you know, we don't do stories, we do facts. But the problem is, if you have on your side, you know, all the numbers, all the evidence, all the facts, and they have on their side all the great stories, all the vision, all the excitement, all the fun, then you lose, you know? And that's why in the end, the most effective neoliberal was not one of their intellectuals, but was Ronald Reagan. You know, he was a movie star and went on to be president, but even more powerfully, kind of vocalized so well these ideas that had got so unfashionable when the Great Depression happened and people realized how harmful they were. But he made them sound joyous and fun and patriotic and spirited. And so it's really important that if we are going to beat back against that, that we don't just think about the policies, but we do think about the power question. How do we build our collective power? And we also think about this question of myth. How do we rediscover stories that will help connect people to a vision of what we can achieve?
That's a really interesting idea. And it's something that, you know, I researched as well, neoliberalism for a long time, and was always struck by that question of how culturally neoliberalism won the culture war. And of course, Margaret Thatcher spoke of it, you know, the battle for heart and minds. She knew that she needed to convince people there was no such thing as society in order to destroy it in a way and reconfigure it in the interests of, you know, capital and finance and business, that the ideas of individualism versus the collective. And what are those stories? Because a lot of the counter narratives, or the narratives that we have or we try to develop, you know, are ones of kind of values of, you know, trying the ideas of cooperation, of solidarity. But what do you think are some of those stories or narratives that we could develop that would progress equality?
I think,
or what are, what ones are being used that are being effective?
Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting things is around what's great about traditions. So as progressives, we rightly challenge what's wrong in our history, right? So, for example, in Ireland, there's been a big push against clericalism, against the damage that clericalism causes, right? But there's also a beautiful set of ideas and values to tap into in terms of the spiritual traditions of Ireland that are really progressive ideas. So ideas of the common good, for example, ideas of the Good Samaritan story is of such a powerful story, two stories in one. Firstly, it tells us to look out for our brother, but secondly, it deliberately elevates the other, the hated outsider, and says, no, look, they are the model of how to be, not the establishment, not the priest and the Levite, but the Samaritan, the hated outsider, is the one that shows how to be. So there are there's a beautiful tradition to be kind of rediscovered and harnessed in terms of the faith of the faithful. There's also a beautiful tradition to be rediscovered, as we've just talked about, in terms of the rebellion and the proclamation and the vision that was held of what Ireland could and should be. So there are powerful progressive ideas too in terms of the value of family, what that means, that says, well, actually, the most important thing isn't work, that actually taking care of our kids is more important. And that's why we should organize our lives not around what works best for capital, but what works best for kids. So these are beautiful ideas that are there in our history. And sometimes as progressives, we don't want to go near them because they have also been associated in warped and twisted forms with huge harm, cruelty, and repression. But if we completely abandon those values and those stories and hand them over, cede them to the people who would use them purely to pursue an agenda in which they can, at the one hand, maximize the wealth of them and their mates, and on the other hand, encourage hatred of the different. If we hand over to them totally the ideas around faith, around family, and around the Irish patriotic tradition, there's three, you know, beautiful assets that we're handing over to the asset strippers. They've already got enough. We don't need to give them any more. So I think we can also find those things that are beautiful within our past and seek to harness them too.
Well, I think it's a really, really important and fascinating area, because it kind of goes beyond, which often those on the left and progressives get stuck in, which is like the politics of righteousness, you know, and the politics of being right, and the politics of, in many ways, you know, a dogmatic kind of, you know, constant critique and constant, you know, which is this negative framework of everything is so wrong and everything that's been done is so wrong. And I think in many ways, And often, as you say as well, it's presented in this, it's constantly trying to present the facts, you know, what are the facts? Because we are, you know, in many cases, the truth is, you know, about inequality and poverty. And, you know, there's so much spinning done by governments and we try to present the facts back. But you're right that the facts don't connect with people. Narrative stories connect with people. And I'm quite struck by there's two things. One is, of course, we have in Ireland, and I know, you know, globally, there's the huge cooperative movement, for example, yeah. And cooperatives. And because the big question that comes to me is like, you know, how do we, because, you know, in the past, you know, there was alternative society. You know, people, you know, acknowledge like, you know, communism, for example, was an alternative that people looked to, obviously, you know, completely wrong in so many ways. But the, you know, that today there's no alternative. And actually my 16-year-old son said it to me, said, you know, there is no alternative to what we live in. You know, everything is, you know, monetized, commercialized. That, you know, where is the alternative that we can point to? And in many ways, you're right, it is our past, but it is a present as well, isn't it? In things like cooperatives that is an alternative way that isn't, you know, the existing capitalist system, but is a different form of system that values equality, values cooperation, but can connect with people.
Yeah, I love what you said on monetizing, the monetizing of everything and the kind of neoliberalizing of the soul. It's really damaging. When we look back on our lives, the things that we most value were never trades. They're always things that were given freely. That's why, you know, that's why blood donation is not something people are paid for, because we're connecting with something deeper and more important. When you were talking about the monetization of everything, I was thinking about how I remember once I got an email saying, "You bought this book on why, you know, why you should have fewer things. Maybe you'll like these other books on why you should have fewer things." And it was so symbolic of the kind of perversion of goodness in us. I really liked what you said about people seeing alternatives. I think people need to live those alternatives. And again, if we think about progressive tactics, I think one of the weaknesses is that we sometimes think that we're in a debate, but actually debates very rarely persuade people. So if somebody is angry and frustrated, and their sense is that the reason why, you know, they are paid so little, have so little free time, are so scared about their future and their health and the safety of their neighborhood, and they think it's because of, you know, immigrants, or they think it's because of feminism, or they think it's because political correctness gone mad, or whatever it is that they've decided to blame as their bogey. Now, if you simply go up to that person and say, "Well, the thing is, you're wrong," and if you read this book, you'd see, no, I mean, it's just never ever worked in history. It just is an utterly alienating form of communication. What does work is this, is when people help people. And that's what's so effective with the cooperative movement. It's also what's so effective with the unionization, that when people are feeling forgotten and alone, when someone comes and says, you know, "I want to help you get the pay that you deserve, get the time off so that you can have time with your family, get the health and safety that you need, the insurance that you worry about in case something goes wrong, the job security, the dignity. I want to help you get those things." Or for a neighborhood, if their park is about to be taken away, or their nursery school or local health center is about to be taken away, and someone comes and says, "No, you know, if we work together as a community, we can preserve it. And after we preserve it, we can even help make it better." Now, those are processes. Those are processes in which flawed, imperfect people come together. And they don't start getting it all. They start confused and maybe unsure. But through the process of winning some small victories, they start to feel, hey, maybe this is not inevitable, this situation that we're in. Maybe there are alternatives. Hey, too. Sometimes we win when we work together. And hey, three, those people who I work together with for this victory, they're not so bad. I was wrong about them. So we need really to think about how we organize and how we connect with people in their everyday experience and help show an alternative. There's really interesting learning about what moves people to act. And just feeling that everything is shit is never enough, you know, and people need to feel hope. And they don't feel hope because you give a great speech. They feel hope in a big thing because you help them win a small thing. And you help tell a story about how that small thing can be the journey to the big thing. So I think the cooperatives that you're talking about are beautiful because they can give people that lived experience. But not everyone can be in a cooperative. So we also need to think about how we make the mainstream economy, the bulk economy, act more like what it's like to be in a cooperative. And we know that the only way that happens is when the employees, the workers, get together and push for it.
And so to conclude then, you know, unfortunately, we are limited in our time in that, even though I'd love to do a very long podcast with you, we keep going and we'll come back. I definitely would love to have you back because it is really fascinating and it's so important as well. I think, you know, the ideas that you're putting across just in terms of that, because, you know, a lot, you know, our listeners are people who care about, you know, inequality deeply. They want to do something. You know, what can people do?
So the first thing is start where you are. I think sometimes people think that they need to wait for something big to come along. But the micro connections are what enables ultimately the macro change. So it's an organized people that can win big things. Disorganized people can win nothing at all. So I would really encourage people to start where they are. Are they a parent? Are they a student? Are they part of a community that they want to help protect or improve their way of life? Do they work for an organization where people wish that they were treated with a bit more dignity and respect? If so, that is where to start. And then secondly, to be a connector, to help bring together different forces. Something really beautiful is happening with Green New Deal, for example. Partly it's just a great idea, but also how it's fusing those people that were thinking about the environment and those people that were thinking about social justice and bringing them together. We need those fusion coalitions more and more. So the second part is to really be a connector, be a storyteller. Don't just share, you know, letters to the editor, but kind of get engaged with your community and find ways to inspire people with real change that you and others are helping to bring about. So those are the things I'd really encourage people to do. Now, there are some great groups that are taking off. So there's the Fight Inequality Alliance that brings together trade unions, NGOs, social movements, faith groups, others, all to push. There are some powerful groups that are fighting for better wages and conditions for those on the front lines. There are people pushing for COVID to be a moment in which we get free healthcare around the world and we get a vaccine to everyone, which means taking the monopolies away from super profitable companies in order that we can make enough of this thing that we don't have to have a fight between countries over a tiny number of doses. So those are some of the great campaigns, but come into them not thinking that that's something disconnected from your community experience. That when your community is organized, that is when transformation happens. Cesar Chavez, who was the great activist in the States, in California, for Latino American farm workers, he said, we don't need perfect political systems. Of course, they'll never come. What we need is perfect participation. And what he meant was that if people get involved, if they connect with each other, then there's no stopping them. So in the same way that we have to break the myth of individualism, the idea that individually we're powerful. We also have to, when we break that myth, not replace it with a fatalism that says, well, we're just stuck, because we are the majority. You know, ordinary people, middle-class people and working-class people are the majority. And the banksters are an absolute tiny fringe. So if we're organized, we can win this.
Ben Phillips, author of How to Fight Inequality, thank you so much for joining me today on Reboot Republic.
Thanks so much, Rory, and good luck. And thanks for all you do.
No, thank you. And it's really inspiring. And I know our listeners will be very, very, you know, engaged, interested, inspired by this. And, you know, it's a really difficult time now, you know, with COVID, with what's going on in terms of organizing, in terms of being hopeful. And I think your idea of this moment of COVID being a point at which we can actually, you know, dream, vision, imagine something different and actually fight for that, I think is central. So thank you so much for your work as well.
Thanks so much. We're going to win.
We are. And so remind all listeners, please support us. We're independent media, the podcast that put out all the experts, frontline analysis, activists, change makers, thinkers. Please support us. Go over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Become a supporter if you can, and support us to keep going. Thank you very much. And we'll talk to you soon.